With our guest this hour, John Lott, we're going to take your phone calls as well as we react to not only the tragic situation unfolding in Baltimore, Maryland right now, but what could unfold across the country if we don't put a lid on it right now. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. John Lott with us. I guess it's during these day and ages, John, I'm glad I'm a concealed weapons permit holder. How about you?
Right. Well, I mean, police are important, but there's limits to what they can do. And surely when the police are even afraid to be in certain areas because of these threats being made against them, you know, what's the option for people to do? And, you know, there are two ways. And just in general, I would say the people who live in these high-crime urban areas, they're the ones who benefit the most from having the option to be able to go and protect themselves. So, you know, I'm not, you know, for you in general, but also particularly for the people who are experiencing this type of violence right now in Baltimore.
When you face people who say, wait a minute, there's no way being a concealed weapons permit holder in a state that the crime in that state is down, what do you tell them?
Well, I mean, just as you can deter crime with higher arrest rates or higher conviction rates or longer prison sentences, the fact that victims might be able to defend themselves can make it costly for criminals to commit crime, to make it less likely that criminals will commit it. I mean, let's say, you know, God forbid you had the urge to go and kick a dog. If it was a pit bull, presumably you'd think twice about kicking it as compared to kicking a small little toy poodle. You know, it's the cost if something's more likely to cause you harm for doing that crime. But look, when I was chief economist at the U.S. Sentencing Commission, I must have read well over 1,000 trial transcripts where you would have two robbers who had been caught. And the prosecution had been able to get one robber to turn state's evidence against the other to testify against him in the trial. And time after time, the story was the same. You know, why did you pick this particular victim to go after? And they would say, because he looked like an easy target. You know, they'd go and list the other targets where they would think the person had more money, but they would, you know, a drug dealer or somebody else, but they would frequently rule it out because it was risky for them to go after that individual. But, you know, just look at these mass killings, just from the last year. It's these guys who commit these crimes are explicit in terms of what they want to try to avoid and right. People being able to protect themselves. So you look at the Santa Barbara killer last year. If you were to read his 141-page manifesto and get by the stuff about him complaining that women didn't appreciate him for about 50 times, he goes into amazing detail about how he picked the places he decided to go and do the attack. And he rules out several places because he says there are people in those areas that may have guns that might be able to stop him. You look at the mass shooting in New Brunswick, Canada last year. The killer there had many comics, had like 12 comics on his Facebook page, dealing with gun-free zones. One of the comics that he had a victim stumbling away from this attacker, and he's looking back at the attacker and saying, but we've banned guns in these areas. You can't shoot me here. It's illegal for you to do that. And the killer has a bubble above his head saying, you know, what a moron, while he's pointing the gun at supposedly going to shoot him next.
Exactly.
The point is, this killer, both of these killers, understood that they wanted to avoid areas where people might be able to go and defend themselves and choosing their targets. We have the Colorado shooter going on, the Batman movie theater started his trial today. Well, in that case, you had 7 movie theaters showing the premiere of the Batman movie within a 20-minute drive of the killer's apartment. Only one of those movie theaters had signs banning permanent concealed handguns.
And that's where he went.
And that's the one he went to.
Yeah. I feel sorry for some of the wonderful African-American leaders in this Baltimore area who are pleading with these people to go home and stop looting, and they can't control this.
Right. No, I mean, you've had people who, you know, have been elected many times. Elijah Cummings, for example, has said things very similar to what you and I have said tonight, that they're just destroying their communities, and they are the ones who are going to be bearing long-term costs of these things. And exactly as you say, he's asked them to cool down and to think about finding out who are the, you know, assuming something was done wrong with regard to Mr. Gray, concentrating then on punishing those that had done something wrong, not the guy who owns some little shop or the CVS store or somebody else who had absolutely nothing to do with that, whose livelihood is being destroyed, as well as the workers and the customers for those stores.
You probably got some young people out there in Baltimore who just don't even know why they're out there looting. They're just doing it. Let's go to the phones.
Yeah.
You ready?
Right.
Let's go to Mike in Clearwater, Florida. Mike, welcome to the program. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi, George. I just have a comment for the guest. I was taught a long time ago, now, by no means do I always agree with what the police do, and by no means, you know, they're always right, but I tell people all the time, look, when you get pulled over, right or wrong, you might as well comply, because you're just not going to win that battle. If you put up a fight, you're going to make it that much worse. And I think a lot of these cases where, you know, people scuffle or run, common sense has got to, look, just do what they tell you to do, and it can all be sorted out later. And I just wanted to hear if the guest, you know, agrees with that, or am I pretty much on the right track?
Well, I agree with it, and John, I'm pretty sure you do, too.
Yeah, sure. No, I agree with it. I mean, it doesn't, if the person does run away, as we were talking about in the South Carolina case, it doesn't justify what happened in that case. But look, I agree. You wouldn't have had the Michael Brown problem. You wouldn't have had the problem in South Carolina. You wouldn't have had lots of other problems that have occurred if individuals had simply said, you know, yes, officer, you know, and gone along with it.
And if you're not wanted, John, for a crime, there is that likelihood, if you're polite to the police officer, he's going to let you go.
Right. Look, I assume, I mentioned before, I've gotten multiple traffic tickets for speeding. I assume if I started arguing with the officer, things would not work well, even if I'm a white male. You know, it's just, if I, so, you know, I do exactly what the caller just said. You know, I say, yes, I know I've been speeding, I'm sorry. You know, I was trying to get to such and such, I shouldn't have been doing it. And, you know, and that's what I do. And I'm sure, you know, the caller is exactly right.
Let's go to Gary in Santa Maria, California, west of the Rockies. Gary, thanks for calling the program. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, George. I was the member of the steering committee on Rebuild L.A. after the April 29th, 1992 riots in L.A., where we had $6 billion to figure out what the race relation problems were. And at the end of that report, Ubroff didn't do much with it. I think that Mr. Lott was a little disingenuous as to what the Attorney General said in his speech on C-SPAN. It's what the report on Ferguson said. I'd like to just cover a couple quick bullet points.
Sure, go ahead, Gary.
All right. The data collected by the Ferguson Police Department shows that African Americans there made up 67% of Ferguson's population. 85% of the vehicle stops, 90% of the citations, 93% of the arrest warrants, despite only comprising 67% of the population. The Justice Department reports that African Americans were at least 50% more likely to be stopped and searched than whites, 50% more likely to have their cases lead to an arrest warrant. 92% of the cases in which an arrest warrant was issued by the Ferguson.
All right, and let's have John react to that, Gary, because he believes that that study was skewed. Go ahead, John.
Right. Well, I mean, the first sentence or so of what you're saying was the exact statistics that I went through there. And let's just take the first thing that you brought up. The question is, first of all, is the 67% the relevant population to look at? The thing is, there's seven cities that border Ferguson, okay? Ferguson's not like a huge, giant city there. There's seven cities that border it, and their average population is about 90% black. So the question is, it'd be useful to know what percentage of the traffic stops? You say 85% of the traffic stops, and I mentioned that number when I was talking to George earlier, are blacks. Now, if 90%, if most of those traffic stops, or most of the citations, you're saying the next number you had was about 90%, most of the citations they're given out are to people from outside of Ferguson, okay? Because that's, a lot of people are saying they're trying to export their tax burden. They mainly, you know, they have these speed traps, for example, which is one of the issues that are there. Well, the speed traps apparently may be set up for people outside of Ferguson. Well, that 90% is pretty close then to the 90% of the population of the other areas. The second thing you just have to recognize is that, for better or worse, there's a lot of evidence that blacks do tend to speed and have other types of traffic violations at much higher rates than whites do. And so it's not necessarily just their shares of the population that's going to be relevant. Now, I know they have one discussion in there about whether the speeding was clocked using a radar detector or by using other means, which presumably means using, you know, following people and trying to
visual
speed that way.
Yeah.
The thing is, I believe that if you were to look at that, what you would find is that when they're using these other means, because they say, look, the rate at which blacks are given tickets is higher when they use other means than when they use the radar detector. Or the thing is, those speed traps are aimed for people who live outside of Ferguson. The speed traps aren't meant to go and get people who live in Ferguson. And if that's the case, then again, you're going to be dealing with this 90% number for the population being black rather than 67. My guess is a lot of the numbers that you just went through would be explained away. You know, the high rate that they go and give things like citations to and others would go away if they just controlled for the residents, the city that the person lived in, rather than just looking at race.
Are those accurate numbers, though, John, or do you think that they're wrong, too?
Just for the sake of argument, I'm willing to accept those numbers being right.
Okay. All right.
Who knows? But even if they are right, it seems pretty obvious to me that they could be easily explained just by taking into account the residents, the city they lived in. And they didn't even try to do that. They don't even talk about that in their entire report. And that's just one example of the types of issues that are going on with this thing. And, I would like to know if they control for these regressions in terms of whether they search a car or other things, some of the other numbers there. Did they account for whether the person had an arrest warrant out for them?
Mm-hmm.
But they don't do that apparently in their work. Why not? Why don't they control for what I would think would be basic things? I mean, I've done a lot of consulting on legal type issues, on discrimination type issues, and I guarantee what they put together, I believe, was a political report, not something that they would actually go and put in a court if they had to go and deal with this in a trial.
Let's go to Rylin in Jackson, Mississippi, who happens to be a police officer. Rylin, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, sir.
Glad to hear that you're a concealed weapon carrier there. I had a couple of talking points I wanted to kind of go over, and if I run over time, just feel free to stop me, which
okay.
I know you will.
Sure.
First, it seems like a lot of these major riots and outbreaks have stemmed from officer-involved shootings, and I saw a FBI crime report, I want to say it was 2013, where it showed a vast majority of officer-involved shootings were dealing with white individuals as opposed to black individuals. So that kind of debunks the stereotype that people are saying now, officers are just killing more blacks than anybody else. Secondly, these officer-involved shootings are a split-second decision. You got officers out there that are just trying to do their job. And if people are cooperative with them, nine times out of ten, they might not even get a ticket if I'm stopping you. It just depends upon the severity of the violation and
right.
Cooperation and attitude, things like that.
Absolutely. I mean, if somebody said to you, oh, my God, officer, I got to get to the hospital. My wife's having a baby. You'd probably take them there.
Absolutely. And, you know, when situations get out of hand, so, someone doesn't want to follow instructions or is making avertive movements, you know, the officer needs to be able to determine whether or not the person is armed. And then if a confrontation breaks out, we've got a use of force continuum that we're trained to use, you know, to escalate up the use of force continuum. If, say, someone is just passive resistive or if they're actively making aggressive movements or actions against you, you know, take it up a notch on the use of force continuum up to deadly force if the nature of the situation presents itself. So you just got to think about the officers out here. We've got a split-second decision to make,
sure,
to make this decision that could, you know, that'll stay with us for the rest of our life, depending upon, you know, what the outcome is. And yeah, I know you've got a few bad apples in every profession, so you might have someone that takes their authority a little overly aggressive, and we have administrators in place that know how to deal with officers like that. And chances are, if you're consistently making racial or inappropriate actions, your department is going to weed you out, and you're no longer going to be employed by a law enforcement agency.
And hopefully right. sooner than later.
Right, right. Exactly. I'd like to quote one of my favorite congressmen, Trey Gowdy. He says that we are a nation of laws. So I if an officer makes a bad decision and he takes someone's life without it being justified, I'm all for putting him up before the grand jury and letting them decide, you know, whether or not it was justified
yeah.
or should stand trial and then go from there. I'm all for that. But, you know, these rioters and people aren't letting it get to that level before they take it there. I'm all for someone's freedom of speech. If they want to have a protest and do it in a peaceful manner, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that as far as I'm concerned. But this taking it to another level and rioting and damaging property and injuring innocent bystanders and law enforcement officers is not going to cut it. And I think as a nation, whenever these situations arise across our country, we need to handle it immediately. And I'm really glad that they're calling in the National Guard up there now. Maybe they can go in there and get a handle on the situation.
Well, and they're going to need that. We're at the break. Officer, thank you for checking in. We've got more police officers calling, and we will have more of your calls when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. So producer Tom is looking for some feedback on Beyond Belief. If you would send him an email through the coasttocoastam.com website, go ahead and take a look at the free trial of the program and just give him some of your comments. Just go to beyondbelief.com. That's www.beyondbelief.com. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. This is our final segment with John Lott. John, of course, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. As we react to the situations in Baltimore, Maryland tonight, Baltimore is under a state of emergency, and it will continue until this situation seems to go away. John, I've got to tell you, I'm getting lots of emails. Very emotional topic, isn't it?
Oh, no, I'm sure it is for many people. And, you know, on both sides, police also. I mean, they're the ones who are threatened. I just want to add one thing. I mean, I thought it was an excellent call, and I
from the police officer.
The officer said before the break. But just to give people an idea, you have about 64,000 times a year the police are assaulted. You have about almost 15,000 times that it results in serious injury to the officer. You have a few hundred times a year where police officers shoot somebody and kill them. So, I mean, you would think if they were really, you know, kind of itching to go and fire their guns at somebody, they'd be firing it a lot more frequently. I mean, they're surely, you know, they're, if somebody's seriously assaulting you and causing serious injury to the officer, that seems the type of thing which would result in a strong response back from the officer. And yet you have these types of killings at just a tiny fraction of that. And, you know, almost a minuscule fraction of all the assaults on police. So, you know, it's not, I think it's just one measure of how responsible police in general behave. That's not saying that every single time, but I think it indicates that the vast majority of them are doing whatever they can to use that as an absolute last resort.
Let's go to Derek in St. Louis. Hey, Derek, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, George, you're from St. Louis, so I don't know if you remember after Darren Wilson shot Michael Brown, just a couple of days afterwards, Jay Nixon, or Governor Nixon, took out advertising on a radio station calling Darren Wilson a murderer and that he was going to get a vigorous prosecution of him without ever looking at the evidence. And it seems like we have leaders that actually are adding to the violence here. That was when the protests went from peaceful to violent. And it would turn out to be a blatant lie, but he actually was advertising that Darren Wilson was a murderer and he was going to get a vigorous prosecution of him. And I think that this mayor, she didn't realize what things that she was saying, but she added to the fire here as well.
Yeah, the mayor in Baltimore apparently tonight, and she's saying that the media may have taken it out of context, but that she was going to give the looters and the people who are destroying and burning space to do what they were doing. I don't think she meant that, John Lott.
Well, I don't know. I mean, she actually said that on Monday. It would have been on Sunday. And, you know, I listened to the audio of it, and it seemed pretty clear to me. There wasn't any qualification that she said there. Look, you know, Governor Nixon made multiple mistakes. One is, just like many other public officials, he presumed the guilt of Officer Wilson.
Big mistake.
But also, when the verdict came in, he basically prevented the National Guard from going in to protect the area.
That's right.
We've had a somewhat related issue in Maryland. The governor apparently was waiting, had tried to call up the mayor of Baltimore, asking her, because the law requires that the mayor has to first request. He just can't send in the National Guard there. And she only returned his calls at about 7 o'clock last evening. And apparently within like 30 seconds he had signed the form. But, you know, it's something that probably should have been called in the day before rather than waiting until the evening was already progressing last night.
But, John, don't you find what's happening something that's symptomatic of something much deeper? It's not just police. There's something, as I've been saying for 2 years now, there's something right. I sense that is wrong with people. They're uptight. It's a pressure cooker. And I think this pressure cooker is ready to blow.
Well, I hope you're wrong. I mean,
I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah, no, I'm sure. Look, there's something to what you're saying, and this pressure, I agree, seems to be getting greater and greater. Anything, people are not waiting for even the beginning of the justice process to go through and try to figure out what happened. You know, I've been involved in the justice process for a good portion of my life, and these things don't occur quickly. I mean, there are people involved in the process, and there's all sorts of legal safeguards that we put in there in order to give people time to put evidence together and present it. You can't even compel everybody to testify against themselves to begin with. You know, they may get a lawyer even if they're innocent. They may get lawyers in these cases, and so. There has to be some patience, but we've gotten to the point now where, you know, it has to be instantaneous determination of who's guilty or not, and that's just we're having huge harm done to the country, and it's just snowballing. So, I mean, I agree. It's pressure cooker is a good analogy.
Yep. John Lott with us, of course. All this happened at Baltimore, of course, with the tragedy of the 25-year-old Freddie Gray, who was taken into custody by Baltimore police for possession of a switchblade. Apparently, he was talking with his friends at the corner, and he started running away, and they went after him and tackled him. They may have had their own reasons why they were chasing him, and he died. Freddie Gray died in police custody. His family says his spine was 80% severed at the neck, and that, there were other injuries. Just strange. That whole picture, John, is weird, isn't it?
Right. No, I mean, I don't have any obvious explanation for what happened there. I would have to know when the injury occurred. So who knows? I mean, it's just pure speculation on my part right now, but I'd agree with you. It doesn't look good. And there may be something bad that happened there. You'd like to believe, in any case, once obviously he was mobile when he was first taken into police custody. The injury occurred sometime after that. So, there better be a good explanation for it. But that doesn't mean there isn't a possibility of a good explanation. I just would want to know what it was before I made a decision.
Let's go to Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Hi, Wayne.
Yes, I just wanted to comment on your guest analysis of the first two cases.
Sure.
In the Mike Brown case in Missouri, there was a couple who were taking video of the whole incident on a phone. And the police realized that they were being taped, and they ran up to the apartment and grabbed the phone. And there has been not one word said about it from either Missouri law enforcement or the Justice Department. Now, in the case of Trayvon Martin, they showed the video of them bringing George Zimmerman into the police station right after he killed Trayvon Martin. There wasn't a scratch on the back of his head. Then all of a sudden, he's got injuries and scratches on the back of his head in the police station. So it seems to me that your guest is leaning toward the defense of these guys, and nobody knows exactly what happened between Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman because nobody actually saw it. People that did see what happened to Brown, like I say, they took the video. So there seems to be this lean toward these policemen who are out of control, and, they need some different type of training because they're too quick to kill people. Like, for instance, that guy in South Carolina, he shot 7 times. The 8th time, he paused a long time before he shot that last shot, aiming for center mass to kill that guy to make that guy go down.
Yep.
So, it's a lot of things that's not right about these police and what they're doing. And I want to say something about those FBI numbers, too. If you do some more research, you'll find out that the FBI numbers are vastly underreported as far as violent crimes are concerned. Just like here in Chicago, if you commit a murder on the Dan Ryan, which is one of our main expressways running straight through the city, the Chicago police don't even classify it as a murder. So, if you shoot and kill somebody on the expressway, it's not classified as a murder.
Huh.
So it's a lot of things that need to be brought out. So I'll just take your comments off there. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak.
Absolutely, Wayne. Go ahead, John. It's your floor.
Right. Yeah, a lot of points there. Just on this last thing, look, Chicago is notorious for not properly counting violent crime rates, murders. There was an excellent article in Chicago Magazine about a year and a half ago, basically under the Rahm Emanuel administration, how they removed the medical examiner, who had been there for 16 years because she wasn't flexible enough in terms of counting these things. And so you have a number of even murders. I mean, you think with dead bodies that you couldn't play with those types of numbers, but they have some amazing stories in that Chicago Magazine article. I know Hardcourt, who's a professor at the law school at Chicago where I was. Probably as bad as Philadelphia was under Ed Rendell in terms of miscounting the numbers. So Look, on the two cases that you talked about, and Ferguson and the Trayvon Martin, I don't know, going and essentially saying that people were hiding that evidence that was there. You know, if you believe that the Obama Justice Department was in on hiding the evidence that was there, you know, I guess you can believe that. There was a lot of eyewitness statements that were taken. One of the things that came through, and there's an excellent article a while ago in the Wall Street Journal about how so many of the witnesses who essentially agreed with what Officer Wilson's story was were afraid to come forward because of the reaction that they thought they'd get from other blacks in the area. And so they were unwilling to testify with regard to what they had seen happen.
Okay,
with
let's...
regard to the Trayvon Martin case, with regard to the Trayvon Martin case, you just go through both the prosecution's medical examiner and the experts that the defense put up. The debate wasn't whether George Zimmerman had his head on the ground and was being pounded into cement. The debate was solely over the number of times that he'd been hit. Neither side disagreed that he had had injuries done there. The camera shot that you're talking about was poor, very grainy shot. It had already been cleaned up by the EMT person who had been there at the scene. And so, you know, and you have the doctor's report from when we went to the hospital. So you'd have to basically go and say that the officer's reports, the doctor's reports, the EMT's report, there was some huge conspiracy among all those people in order to try to hide this. And I just don't think, whether it's the Obama administration or whether it's an EMT, it's hard for me to figure out what his bias would have been to do it, that all those people in both of those cases were somehow conspiring to hide evidence. I just don't see it.
Let's take a call from Cornelius in Louisiana. Cornelius, welcome to the show, sir.
Hello.
Yeah, hi there.
Oh, okay, I couldn't tell at first. I was a 15-year military police officer, and within 24 hours, we had to have our reports done. And in Baltimore, it's taken them 10 days, and that's just wrong. And Ferguson, that officer was innocent. Now that he's getting sued in a civil suit.
Yeah.
And they're not going to win. But all that is just dragging things out. It was all a lie, hands up, don't shoot, you know. And I feel sorry for, because a lot of blacks, and I happen to be African-American, they just believe whatever Jesse Jackson says or Reverend Al Sharpton and stuff. And just like you saying, John, you know, the evidence is there to prove that that never did happen. Now, Zimmerman, that's a different story. I think the man should have never got out the car and just waited, you know, till the police got there. But...
Right.
Cornelius, thanks.
Look,
go ahead, John. Couple minutes left.
Well, I mean, again, I wish you could get evidence instantly on these types of things. It's a little bit different between how military justice works and it works in the civilian world that's there. But, you know, officers can't be made to go and provide evidence against themselves. My guess is the police union is instantly lawyered up, at least a couple of the officers that are there. And so they may look bad by getting lawyers instantly and not talking, and they may have done something wrong. I don't know. Obviously we have cases like the South Carolina case where one can only feel very sorry for the victim in that case and know that the officer did something wrong. But with regard to the Trayvon Martin case, I don't know. I mean, it seems. He could have stayed in the car. He thought, when one listens to the audio there, that he had been asked by the 911 operator to go out and look around. When he realized, when she said he didn't need to do that,
and he realized he wasn't supposed to do that. He went was going back to his car, he said, on that. So, but look, whether or not he was in or out of his car, there's no justification for him to have been attacked. And, you know, I just, you know, at that point, when you're being attacked and on your back and somebody slamming your head in the concrete, you know, it becomes similar to a lot of the points that we're raising right now. You know, be good to police officers. You know, don't, you know, if you see somebody, don't initiate an attack against them.
Same with road raging. You get run off the road, don't go follow them and attack.
Right. And if people did that, none of these problems would be occurring. So, but they're there, and we have to deal with them somehow. But I guess my only caution would be the same one that Elijah Cummings has made, and that is, who is a Democratic congressman from Baltimore, and that is, you know, keep calm. Let's punish people who did something wrong rather than punishing everybody else in the community, including themselves in the long run. And but, you know, as George, you've said, a lot of people are there. You know, you have some troublemakers that are there.
Yep.
And they're going to punish all sorts of other blacks, all sorts of other blacks. You know, some law-abiding black who has been working hard at the CVS store there, who never would have thought about trying to break in and loot places or set things on fire, is going to find himself out of a job now.
I know it.
Because somebody else, you know, backed his car into one of the walls at the CVS and tried to take out loot that was there, and other people set the place on fire.
They have got to really crack down on the looters and those who are destroying property. They can't just let them throw little Molotov cocktails in the buildings, John.
Right.
All right, John Lott, thank you so much for being on the program again. A two-hour special on the situation in Baltimore, Maryland, and I'm sure things are tense now and will be tense tomorrow, too. I'm George Norrie. It's the 25th anniversary of the Hubble Space Telescope. Hey, space historian Robert Zimmerman joins us next.